Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you guys today?
Dandy.
Doing great.
Before we get started on this week's show, I want to tell everyone a bit about RebellerMedia.com. RebellerMedia.com is a one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day, I and my crack team of editors will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report, but for Hollywood. After you are done checking out the day's headlines, we hope you'll stick around and enjoy some Rebeller originals. Jacob Knight had a great piece for us this week on Don Johnson's career. I really enjoyed a tribute by Simon Abrams to the Japanese B-star Joe Shishido, who passed away recently. We are paying good people good money for the content you're enjoying, including the content you're enjoying right now. And we hope you will sign up for a membership, which will give you unlimited access, either $2 per month or $20 for the whole year. That is less than most Patreons, and you get so much more bang for your buck. Now, on to the show. First up at Controversies and Nontroversies, we look at the dangers of juggling issues like race and sex and discrimination and violence against women when it comes to filmmaking and the world of documentaries. Just days before its premiere at Sundance, the new documentary On the Record lost its biggest backers, Oprah and Apple. Yes, the beloved talk show host and the kinda sorta beloved mobile phone producer bailed on the documentary about women who accused rap mogul Russell Simmons of sexual assault because... it's kind of hard to say exactly why. Oprah thought it needed another pass. Ava DuVernay apparently gave the movie the thumbs down. There's some suggestion that there was uneasiness over white filmmakers making a movie about rape accusations against a black man. And there's all sorts of kind of, you know, questions about whether or not the accusers are to be trusted. So, Alyssa, I have a question here. Is this a case of intersectionality gone bad?
Oh, boy. I mean, I kind of hate discussions about intersectionality and culture, not because I think that it's a bad concept, but because I think that intersectionality itself is sort of commonly has been used in cultural discussions in a way that obscures what the original concept was, which is incredibly legally useful. And the idea behind intersectionality from the scholar who promulgated it is that there are places where sort of multiple sources of oppression work together and create circumstances that can't be addressed only by looking at, say, sexism or racism without looking at those forces interdependently.
And well, isn't that exactly what's happening here, though?
Well, I mean, it's... just worth the clarification. I think that there are a bunch of ways that race and class and gender are intersecting here. And the buzzword, I think, kind of obscures efforts to actually sit down and look at what's going on. So the filmmakers who made On the Record have made a couple of fairly well-regarded documentaries about sexual assault before. One about rape in the military and one about rape on college campuses. I personally thought the first one was better and somewhat more nuanced than the one about sexual assault on college campuses, but that's sort of to the side. So they are sort of well-versed on this side of the subject. And part of what is coming to play in the way that Oprah Winfrey is talking about this and coverage about this is coming out is it becomes a question of sort of who gets to decide what counts as an authentic look at sort of the atmosphere around hip hop in the 90s. And so Deborah Dixon, who is at the center of On the Record, was an executive at Def Jam, worked with Russell Simmons, who she says raped her. Oprah brought in Ava DuVernay, who also worked in the music business before becoming a director, to sort of assess for her whether the movie was an accurate look at, again, R&B sort of in the same period. And so it's sort of a weird story because it's not as if this is Ava DuVernay's judgment against the judgment of a couple of white filmmakers. It's Ava DuVernay's judgment of whether the story that another black woman is telling about her experience in the music business, it's about which one of them gets to decide what's sort of authentic and accurate. Winfrey, I think, clearly feels some tension over the movie. She had sort of initially publicly announced her involvement with this in December. The filmmakers say that she was actually involved a lot earlier, which makes it sort of strange that some of these issues wouldn't have been addressed. And so the whole thing is just a huge mess that's really disappointing, I think, especially for women who have trusted Winfrey to be someone who speaks forthrightly about issues of sexual violence, who herself is a survivor of sexual violence. And it's just a mess. And it's a really disappointing mess that clearly should have been aired out long before the Sundance Film Festival actually started.
Peter, what are your thoughts here?
Well, I haven't seen the movie, and so
right.
It's very difficult
we
for
should
me
clarify
to,
that none of yeah. us have actually seen the movie here. We're talking solely about the kind of controversy surrounding pulling it or trying to get it pulled at the last minute here.
So I haven't seen the movie, and I, you know, as a result, I cannot assess the claims about whether the movie does its job well, whether the movie tells a story that is probably true, whether it is a good piece of journalism. I will say that one of the filmmaker's previous documentaries that Alyssa mentioned, The Hunting Ground, was predicated on some social science research about rape on college campus that is really pretty dubious, and that my colleague Robbie Suave at Reason Magazine has written pretty persuasively to my mind that some of the key core, you know, the core research that has suggested that there is a sort of serial predator aspect in which campus rapists go about their sort of target people in certain ways is based on that research is pretty shoddy, and there's real problems with it, and that was featured very prominently in The Hunting Ground, and the filmmakers pretty much refused to address the criticisms there. So again, I haven't seen this new documentary. I don't know what, if any, problems there may be. It may be a perfectly accurate story. It may not be. But the other thing is, it's not clear. Part of the problem with this to me is it's not clear what the actual concerns are. And if you read, there was a review in Slate that talked about some of the possible criticisms that DuVernay may have had, and it seems as if part of what she might have been objecting to was not even so much the story itself about Simmons, but the way the movie apparently, again, haven't seen it, but the way the movie apparently attempts to tie Simmons's actions to the culture of hip hop in the era. And if that's the case, I suppose I can believe that that's true, having seen Kirby Dick's documentary about the X rating in Hollywood, and, you know, sort of some of the ways that he makes cultural accusations about how that came about and how, you know, sort of how Hollywood portrays sex. And so I guess I think this is just, it's a hard thing to talk about without having seen the film. It also would be really nice if the people involved would be clearer with the public, but certainly with each other, about what it is they object to, because the reporting that I've read says that the filmmakers found out that Oprah Winfrey was pulling her support about with 20 minutes
20 minutes
notice before she pulled out. And that seems like not an ideal way to do business for anyone. And it creates all sorts of kind of suggestions of what's going on here, what's the problem, that no one can really answer if they're on the outside. And possibly the filmmakers don't even know themselves.
Alyssa, this also kind of dovetails, this whole story kind of dovetails with another thing that both you and I wrote about last week, which is Sundance and its relationship to Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is another instance where gatekeepers and powerful people spent a lot of time and energy essentially covering up for a sexual predator because they thought they could get something for him, or they didn't, from him, or they did not want to rock the boat here. And Peter is right. It's hard to say exactly what the motivations are here, because nobody seems to be want to be very honest about what the problems are with this movie or with the presentation of it.
And it's worth noting that this has been clearly very painful for Dixon. She gave an interview to the Los Angeles Times where she talked about what it was like to, you know, think that she was done telling this story and then have the filmmakers come back to her, be grilling her. Her perception is that one of the people who raised concerns to Winfrey may have been, you know, a former sorority sister of hers. And so there is a real person at the center of this who is not, you know, is not empowered in any way to make decisions about how this movie is edited, when it comes out, how it's released, but who is being put through a lot all over again because the people who made this movie and were supposed to be distributing this movie seemingly can't get on the same page with each other.
And again, this calls to mind the Harvey Weinstein case, which is currently in trial right now. There are people testifying about how Weinstein, you know, raped them, and, you know, everybody says, oh boy, this is so shocking and terrible. I couldn't believe it was going on. I don't know if that's, you know, I don't know how much credence we want to put in that, but like it does. Here's my thing. I think Ava and Oprah are getting, and Apple, also, they're all getting kind of a pass here. Nobody really wants to come out and criticize them, for essentially pulling the rug out from under this thing, or trying to. Now, it looks like after the standing ovation reception that it got at Sundance and all of this other drama, that the movie will probably wind up getting distribution from somebody, Neon or Netflix or whoever. But I do think that I get a very real sense of history repeating itself.
And I don't know that it's necessarily equivalent. It's worth acknowledging that, I mean, there are 20 other women on the record who have said that Russell Simmons behaved improperly to them in various ways. So to a certain extent, you know, the story is out in this particular case. But yeah, I think that it feels really messy to have someone who made her brand in part on, you know, creating space to talk honestly about these kinds of issues, has pulled the platform out from under this kind of story. And it feels really messy that someone who has become a really powerful spokesperson for telling different kinds of stories and empowering different kind of voices in Hollywood reportedly played a role in shutting this kind of story down. And I think that even if this is not directly equivalent to the conspiracy of silence around Harvey Weinstein, it illustrates the limits that supposed truth tellers have in Hollywood. Everyone is going to run up against something where it tests their commitment or their principles, or even if they don't think that something is, you know, quite up to standard, where making that decision puts them in a position where they appear to be compromised. And so, you know, a really interesting test of this post-Me Too era in Hollywood is going to be whether people in Hollywood who were sort of neutral actors can become good actors, but also whether good actors on these subjects can stick to their guns all the way through, or find a way to explain what's happening when they appear to be violating their own principles.
Can I ask you guys a quick question? Do you think that there's any chance that Oprah pulling her support inadvertently drew more attention to this film and is going to elevate both the film and its accusations? I mean, I think
100%.
I don't think we'd be talking about it.
Yeah.
Certainly on this podcast. What? If Oprah had not pulled her support. And I suspect that a lot of the advance coverage of it would not have happened, or would have not have happened in quite so high profile a way had she not pulled her support. And so she's backing out of kind of her personal, you know, putting her name on it, in some ways what she's doing is drawing even more attention to this. I'm not saying that's her intention. I'm not saying that she's like secretly trying, that this is her, you know, backdoor, like super, super clever, super secret way of actually making this documentary even more high profile. But probably inadvertently, almost certainly inadvertently, that's probably what she did.
Yeah. And I mean, Dick and Zaring's previous movies about sexual assault were, you know, they're documentaries. They were not huge hits in either case. I think they were followed by people who are interested in the issues already, but neither one of them was sort of a breakout transformational story. And this would have been another installment, but I don't know that it was ever going to be a game changer, especially because it wasn't as if they were bringing forward allegations that had not been previously aired, or allegations against someone who had not previously been accused.
Okay, so do we think it's a controversy or a non-controversy that this movie faced a pullout of it by its backers at the 25th hour?
Yeah, it's absolutely a controversy.
It's a controversy.
Controversy. It is, in fact, a controversy. Okay, on to our main attraction, Guy Ritchie's new British gangster flick, The Gentlemen. Taking a break from big-budget studio blockbusters like Aladdin and Chav King Arthur, Ritchie returns to the gangster action comedy heist thriller-type movie that he made his name with, movies like Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch. The Gentlemen is twisty-turny in the best sort of way, weaving together disparate strands of a storyline until they all come together right at the end, and then kind of come together again at the end. The further end. Mickey, played by Matthew McConaughey, is an American Rhodes Scholar who has captured Great Britain's weed market. He wants to retire and hopes to offload his operation to another American, a Jewish gangster looking to make a quick buck. The story comes to us via the fey journalist Fletcher, played by Hugh Grant, who is recounting various shenanigans to Charlie Hunnam's Raymond as the story winds and weaves together. I haven't even mentioned Colin Farrell yet, who's fantastic in this movie. I'm going to be honest, I loved it. It will almost certainly end up on my top 10 list at the end of the year. It is very much in my mode of, like, entertaining and button pushing. I am very much here for Guy the Gangster.
Sonny, be honest with us. You only liked it because of the menswear. This was entirely...
This is true.
If this movie had no dialogue, no plot, nothing, no cleverness to it, and everyone had appeared on screen dressed... as they are, if this movie had been a still frame of all of the characters dressed in their best outfits, you would have loved it.
You could have called this movie Layering Cake, if you will. But I do think it is. I do think it's interesting how Guy Ritchie has mellowed a bit with age. This is, in a way, it's a more contemplative picture. It's definitely still stylized, but things like the hip-hop montages and the shaky zooms from Snatch are gone.
Wait, there is a whole YouTube hip-hop montage.
No. There was a hip-hop song. There's a hip-hop song. It's not the same as a hip-hop montage. Hip-hop montage is like
from
Requiem
video,
for a Dream. Yes, it's an in-world YouTube music video. There's a difference between a hip-hop montage and a music video, Peter Suderman. That is a term of art. Look it up. Replacing these are it's and look there's a bit of reflection here on age and the nature of aristocracy and what the Great Britain of the future is going to look like here. Peter, what do you think of The Gentlemen?
There was a lot that I liked about this movie. It's very stylish. Some of the performances are great. Charlie Hunnam, who I frequently do not like, I think gave the best performance I believe I have ever seen by Charlie Hunnam. He is menacing and cool and collected and completely believable, expertly plays this kind of high-level number two in Matthew McConaughey's, you know, giant-sized pot distribution network. I did not love the movie, however, and I didn't love it for almost exactly the same reasons. It reminded me of the inverse of the Kingsman films. And the Kingsman films by Matthew Vaughn, who has been a producing partner for Guy Ritchie. We discussed him on the previous episode. He produced Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. Matthew Vaughn has gone on to have his own quite high-profile career in which he makes these kind of highly stylized movies with great menswear that just go a little bit over the top in terms of violence. Both Ritchie and Vaughn seem to not quite know where to stop. And yet, Matthew Vaughn's movies always resolve in this sense that the elite, that the good people in the world have a duty to decency and a duty to be good and to wear their power, their influence, and their clothes extremely well and carefully and in a way that is designed to be good and to create good in the world. And Guy Ritchie ultimately just sort of says, you know what, vulgarity and style are wonderful and awesome and I just enjoy them and that's it. And so you end up with movies that are, again, like I said, they have some great bits in them. They look wonderful. They're really cool for moments at a time, but ultimately they're kind of empty and they're kind of vulgar and they're kind of mean-spirited. They just don't have anything at their core, or at least not anything nice, not anything decent, not anything respectable in the way that I think Vaughn really goes out of his way to put into his movies.
It's interesting because I do think that Ritchie has a bit more jaundiced view toward the British upper class than Vaughn does. Certainly in this film, much more so in this film. I mean, this film has a whole subplot, spoilers, for the record.
I wanna...
spoilers, as always. But this film has an entire subplot about how the weed merchants of Britain are essentially paying off the landed aristocracy to hide their weed production capabilities. And it is kind of a fascinating little dig at what money will do to perpetuate itself.
The pot legalization aspect really calls back to Kingsman 2, The Golden Circle, which is, again, another a very populist film about pot legalization. It's much more cartoony and violent. I actually really want to hear what Alyssa has to say, because I know she's got some really interesting things, thoughts on this film. But I would just say that, to me, Matthew Vaughn versus Guy Ritchie is a great example culturally of good populism versus bad populism. And Matthew Vaughn's populism is real, and he really doesn't like elites. And that's very clear in the first Kingsman film, is that he kind of finds the global self-satisfied smug elite to be really just unpleasant and worthy of the bad things should happen to them, is what he thinks.
Well,
and at the same time, there is a sense of moral duty there that I just think doesn't exist in Guy Ritchie's films, because Guy Ritchie is just sort of too narcissistically self-involved and just wants to sort of see people get their comeuppance, and that's it. Anyway, I've said too much here, I'm sure.
I question whether or not I don't think you're wrong. I just don't think it's a bad thing. Alyssa, you had a pretty searing take on this movie. I wonder if you could explain it to the listeners.
Sure. And I want to just preface this by saying, like, on this podcast, we mess around sometimes and I get to be the sort of, you know, avatar of the humorless liberal. But I need a break from that here to talk about this movie, because it really, really disturbed me. And it disturbed me despite the fact that I enjoyed a lot of it very much. I mean, Peter and I saw this movie together, and I kept sort of looking over at him, and I think it was clear for a lot of the run of the movie that I was enjoying it more than he was.
I couldn't quite tell if you were enjoying it or looking at me like, can you believe what they just put on the screen in front of us?
But the thing that really deeply disturbed me about this movie is what I think is its fairly inarguable anti-Semitism. And I don't mean that it's anti-Semitic because it has a Jewish gangster in it. I don't care about that. One of the principles of equity in Hollywood and in storytelling is that members of minority groups are not obligated to only be paragons and can only be heroes, and that's the only way to humanize them. Actual equality means that if you are a minority, you have as much right to be bad and interesting and compelling all at the same time as a straight white man does. But this is a movie where the Jewish gangster is criminal in ways that reflect, that draw on very deeply held stereotypes of Jews. Jeremy Strong's character is not just a Jewish crook who's interested in cornering the weed market. He is cheap. He is underhanded in how he pursues sort of driving down the price of Mickey's empire. He is in league with other model minorities, the Chinese gangsters played by, among other people, Henry Golding, who sort of broke out as one of the stars of Crazy Rich Asians, and uses young black men and young working class white men as sort of cat's paws to accompany this. So he is... I mean, he's cheap, he is underhanded, and he is sort of, you know, basically using this kind of diverse coalition in an underhanded way as this sort of conspiratorial cat's paw to drive down the price of this business that he wants to purchase. And then at the end of the movie, Ritchie does something really ugly and uncomfortable. He has Mickey lock Jeremy Strong's character in like a freezing locker and demands that he excise a pound of his own flesh in retribution for Matthew having set up the attempted rape of Mickey's wife, Roz. And for folks who aren't familiar with this, this is an inversion of the key plot point in Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice, where the main character in that story is Shylock, this Jewish moneylender who has been abused by the Christian merchants of the city. His business has kind of been destroyed. And he demands that if Antonio, the hero of the story, can't pay back his debt, that he gets a pound of Antonio's flesh. And in The Merchant of Venice, the fact that he actually tries to call in that debt is sort of an expression of Shylock's monstrosity. And you can sympathize with Shylock to a certain point. He's been the victim of anti-Semitism. He's been under, you know, enormous pressure. He's had his business compromised by these characters. But it's still a sign of his essential monstrosity. And the gentleman inverts that and says that it is good that a Gentile character is doing this to a Jewish character because he is avenging his family appropriately and protecting his business and restoring order to the world. And the fact that he is doing this theoretically to protect a Jewish woman felt like a really sort of cheap dodge to me. It's an attempt to say, it's like, oh, we're not anti-Semitic. This cool, you know, collected character played by Michelle Dockery, who's the star of Downton Abbey. It's like she is set up as Jewish only to provide cover for the rest of the things that the movie says about Jews. And I get that it's easy to sort of say that all of this stuff is like kind of fun and daring, but Hollywood has for a long time been an arena that makes movies about how Nazis are bad, how anti-Semitism is bad, and that a movie can get by and say the kinds of things that, say, Ilhan Omar is condemned for saying, says something not good about the state of anti-Semitism in America and Britain. I think it's really disturbing. And it's more disturbing for me for how compelling the movie is at just getting me to like it in a lot of other ways.
What did you think of the bit in the middle of the movie? It's just a brief exchange between Colin Farrell and another character in which Colin Farrell calls somebody,
another character.
Was it Colin Farrell?
No.
Involved in
so
this?
Colin Farrell plays this, he's involved in it. So Colin Farrell plays like this boxing gym coach, effectively. Yeah. That's the easiest way to summarize what his role is, who's some of his trainees have gotten involved in robbing Mickey's place. And one of the white members of his crew calls a black member of the crew a black insert slur here. And the Afro-British character understandably gets offended at this and then ends up in this weird little debate with Colin Farrell's character about whether or not it's racist. And it's one of those things, it's like, it's very funny. It's, you know, it is deftly written. It's a great example of how Ritchie just gives such, he just gives his actors great material yep. when he tries. But at the same time, it's a dodge, right? I mean, it's literally an argument that if you care about sort of race, anything else, that like you're a humorless patsy. And it's so obvious in what it's doing that, I mean, I admire the chutzpah a little bit, but it's also so self-justifying that it's like, yeah, it's cute. I see what you're trying to do, and actually you don't get away with it.
But he does. He does get away with it. I thought that scene in particular was very funny. Now, I will say, I read your piece before seeing the movie and kind of watched for the anti-Semitism throughout. And I will say, I find your argument compelling to a certain extent. I do question whether or not the intent was to make Mickey look monstrous there at the end. The movie is there's an earlier portion of the film where Ritchie does a very clever thing. We watch McConaughey's character kind of grow up through the weed game, and instead of like trying to use de-aging technology or some such, the camera just follows him from behind. And we see a kind of shaggy haired guy who looks like he could be something like McConaughey going about doing his business. And at first it's just like, you know, selling the toffs, the weed and getting the money and blah, blah, blah. But there comes a point where he is forced to do violence. He is forced to do serious violence. And we see the kind of dripping machete and how horrifying that can be. And we see other parts of the movie where that sort of violence is used again, except it's a an imagined plot point by the Hugh Grant journalist character. It doesn't actually happen. The shootout in the restaurant, right?
I mean, that scene is really notable for being like
Henry Gold,
for being a kind of classic Guy Ritchie hang a bell on what I'm doing scene, in that he's saying, look, this, you, like, he's basically saying, isn't excessive violence really enjoyable? Doesn't it look great? Doesn't it add a spark of fun? And I think with the epithet scene that we were talking about earlier, he's making the same case for crude racial and ethnic stereotypes, which is just all over all of his movies. He just really thinks they're amusing and useful for telling stories and for building characters.
And I want to push back on the idea that what Mickey does at the end, which I think is not supposed to be the Hugh Grant character's invention, is I don't think it's presented as bad for two reasons. The first is that the movie kind of makes a cannibalism joke about it. There's been this running gag about Ray cooking the Hugh Grant character a steak on his like super fancy grill. And you have the like, Mickey hands Matthew a scalpel, locks him in the locker, and then you cut to a scene where Ray is cooking another steak but won't say what the meat is. And so it's treated as if it's kind of funny and a joke on the Hugh Grant character. But then, you know, the movie starts with this totally overblown aphorism about like demonstrating that, you know, you're the king of the jungle, that you're super dominant. And then we return to that aphorism at the end with the addition, and this, we return to the aphorism at the end after Mickey has done this, and we learn that it's something that his wife told him, right? Like, he has done this in her defense and on her advice. She is presented as like the canniest character in the movie. And so I would argue instead that the movie ends up suggesting that Mickey's return to strategic violence is good and noble and honorable. And
I totally agree with that, because what Guy Ritchie loves is street vengeance. And that is his whole ethos, is his movies are about people getting what they deserve, not about some higher morality or justice or sense of decency. And that's why, like I said, as much as I kind of enjoyed parts of this movie and think that there's some very good scenes, very good characters, I just couldn't enjoy the whole thing because it's too mean-spirited in the end.
If you invoke Shylock like that, and take something where this is bad and monstrous when a Jew does it, but it's good and admirable when a Gentile does it to a bad Jew, that is anti-Semitism. And it's really the idea that no one in an industry that is famously sensitive to this was like, guys, I mean, I don't talk or write about this a lot because it's not my beat, but the rise of anti-Semitism in America and Britain is really disturbing. And I think this movie, depending on what happens next, should be a kind of asterisk on that. Because if you can say this in a big mainstream Hollywood movie that dominates the box office, there are a lot of places you can say it, and that should bother us.
Okay, so thumbs up or thumbs down here. What do we say?
Parts of it I liked, but I have to go with thumbs down.
Despite everything I've said, I mean, I think it is sort of a stylish, enjoyable movie about the movies, and you should watch it both because you should see what's disturbing about it, but also because it's really well made. And it's kind of a good example of how good seductive filmmaking can take you places that you shouldn't actually go. So thumbs up. You should watch it.
Thumbs up. Okay, great. Let's move on to assigned viewing. Up this week is Snowpiercer, one of the many films that recognizes the true villainy of environmentalists. As we remember, at the beginning,
another movie about people eating people. So,
at the beginning of the movie. Remember, this is the environmentalists tried to block out the sun, and then it killed us all, except for the people on the train who had to eat the bugs. and
the,
put their
the bugs
put their
among
children,
other things
put their children into the machine. Okay, Peter, this movie also has, you know, a class message of some sort. I think I don't really remember. Why are we watching Snowpiercer this week?
We are watching Snowpiercer because it is directed by Bong Joon-ho, who is the director of Parasite, one of the movies nominated for Best Picture this year. Like Parasite, Snowpiercer is a big metaphor genre film in which the environment itself is a metaphor for class differences and class conflict, and creates a lot of class conflict that plays out in interesting and twisted ways. In the case of Snowpiercer, it is a story about a post-apocalyptic world in which, in an attempt to solve global warming with to stop global warming via chemicals, the entire world has been wiped out in a kind of ice storm, and the only vestige of humanity is a train that now circles the globe. That train is the Snowpiercer, and the train itself is divided by class, with the lower classes crammed into ugly and unfortunate cabins in the back, and the upper classes living in luxury in the front. It's a very clever action movie and a very clever metaphor film. I watched it again last night, and I just have to say I love this movie. I love the look of it. I love the way it I love the design. I love the way that it uses the space to tell the, not just to tell the story, but to send the message, but then also to build these incredibly elaborate action sequences. There's a really great scene sequence at the end of the second act in which the train is going around a curve. And so they start shooting at each other from one train car to the other through the curve. And they use this, the shape of the train tracks as part of the action itself. The movie does a lot of clever stuff like that. When I was looking up how this movie was made, I found that they actually built a sequence of four train cars for every scene that they were shooting, and then put it on top of a moving gimbal, so that the actors and the camera would be on sets that actually moved like train cars. And this is something that you can see in the film, is that there often you can see into the next car and that it's kind of swaying and moving with them. And it gives the movie this real sense of kind of uneasy propulsion as they are moving from the back to the front of the car. And then eventually Chris Evans, who is our protagonist here, who is
and
the leader of the rebellion.
This is absolutely the best performance Chris Evans has ever given by
a significant
margin.
The monologue that he gives in the transition between Act 2 and Act 3, where he talks about, as we've discussed,
I hate that I know what people taste like.
Yeah.
I hate that I know that babies taste best. Like,
it's haunting and brutal and just incredibly well acted. And then in the end, he meets basically God, the conductor of the train, the person who invented this crazy train, played by
Ed Harris,
who is just delightful. And so I love this movie. I think I actually like it better than Parasite, as much as I did like Parasite. And I like it because it's an action movie, but it's not just smart about its action. It uses its action as a forum for big ideas. And almost all of my favorite medium to small budget genre films, going back to stuff like The Thing and Escape from New York and, you know, all the kind of John Carpenter films from the early 80s, they're all movies about ideas. They're not just action for their own sake. And when we get to talking about another movie next episode, I'm going to contrast this film, which has a bunch of big ideas that are embedded into its structure and into its action, with Sucker Punch, which is just kind of empty, beautiful
spoiler
visuals.
Spoiler, Peter. I would say that Snowpiercer actually works much, much better than Parasite for a variety of reasons, but one is its simplicity. It is first and foremost an action movie, and it is designed as an action movie, and the metaphor at the heart of the film, the class conflict, the moving up the from the steerage to first class, is so ingrained into society and also just like the conveyance upon which they are traveling, that it doesn't actually need to be, you know, hammered home with an unsubtle speech at the end.
I mean, the I ate babies speech is kind of unsubtle. No, it's great.
But that's just,
but it's
just
part also of, no, a very kind no, of messagey no, 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 speech no. about how class conflict
it's not,
and being
it's not,
expected
it's not
to just sort of
it's
stay
not a
in your
about
lane.
How you have to go to college. To work your way through the class structure so you can buy your father out of bondage.
I mean,
spoiler,
it's better than a movie that ends with a monologue about campaign finance reform.
But the, well, yes, well, that it's certainly better than that. I don't know. Alyssa, I feel like we saw this movie together.
I think
at
we did.
The West End theater on that tiny, terrible little screen in like the folding chairs. many years ago. How was revisiting it?
Man, I love this movie. I actually think I might love it more than Mad Max Fury Road, which is saying a lot. And I think Peter is right that the action sequences are amazing and express ideas, right? Like that opening sort of dash through the train car doors where, for example, you need to have collective action to wedge the doors open, but only one person can get through, or like a small number of people can get through. I mean, that is design that's about class struggle, right? Like you need an enormous amount of collective work to lift even a couple of people up and have a shot at changing the system. But it's also just, it's a script that manages to wedge in so many different ideas and to have them all feel natural, right? I mean, the setting, for example, in the schoolroom where you have like Allison Pill's like deranged, pregnant, fundamentalist teacher who also like has a bunch of guns and a basket of eggs. It's like, it's literally a train car about the role of religion in this class society. And it's like, it's expressed incredibly well. They move on from it. You don't need to belabor the metaphor. Allison Pill is great in general and is particularly great in that scene. You have the twist where it turns out that, you know, Wilford, the Ed Harris character, and Gilliam, the leader of the folks in the tale, have actually been working together to have these periodic revolutions as this blowing off of steam, but that like Gilliam was in fact entirely bought out and never intended to upend the system because he didn't believe it was possible. I mean,
all those poverty activists are just in the pocket of big engine, big God, I don't know.
The sacred engine, Peter. So, I mean, it's a script that does an enormous amount of intellectual work, sort of knitting all of these ideas about collective action and religion and, you know, revolution versus incrementalism and movement leaders and environmental change and hope. And I mean, it just does an enormous amount of work without ever feeling forced or luxury. And I think that's another place where the sort of the train car sequence kind of expresses that, right? I mean, you sort of have the military-industrial complex in one car in the sort of blackout fight sequence where you have people with axes going up against people with guns and night vision goggles. You have, you know, religion in the Allison Pill kindergarten car. You have, you know, the revelation.
Decadence.
Yeah, you have decadence.
You have the decadence train.
Yes. And so, I mean, the fact that it does, you know, for all that The Gentleman drove me nuts and I love this movie, it's sort of fitting to discuss these two incredibly chock full and yet kind of effortless scripts in the same episode because they're both just really impressive examples of screenwriting.
I will say that The Gentleman's a little more self-consciously clever. It is as many directors who try to make a film that is about the movies, it kind of inverts in on itself. It's eating the tail a little bit.
It's more self-consciously
Snowpiercer.
It's more self-consciously clever about its dialogue and about its plotting. Snowpiercer is quite consciously clever about its structure and about the ways that its metaphor informs every single aspect of what you see and how the story moves. And, you know, again, to preview a little bit of our discussion of Parasite has this funny bit where the family that is at the center of the story, they will often sort of see something will happen, and they'll say, oh, it's very metaphorical, because of course Bong Joon-ho's movies are all just these giant, incredibly elaborate, perfectly executed metaphors. And so I think it's clever in a different way. I guess the thing that I appreciated most about Snowpiercer, just as sort of a message movie, was that it's very smart about complicity. It doesn't make everybody in the back of the train
perfect, you know, sort of innocent people who are, who have done no wrong, who could never do wrong, who aren't involved in anything shady. It says very clearly that our protagonist, who gets what's coming to him to some extent at the end,
is a cannibal and a murderer.
Is a person who did not start as a good-hearted revolutionary trying to fight the system. He started as somebody who was just out to get what was his. And the movie does a really interesting job of talking about the ways of, or describing and suggesting the ways that class struggle turns everyone into a villain. And that thinking of yourself as being involved in a permanent class struggle makes you villainous to some extent, and makes you part complicit in the system that is perpetuating all the things that you think you're trying to stop.
Well, and it's a story about a group of people who have convinced themselves that preserving the system is the only way to stay alive, and have become so invested in that system that they have noticed what's going on around them outside, which is that it's now possible for life to survive on the surface again. And so they are propping up a system that is both profoundly unmoral and ultimately unnecessary.
Well, all those people are going to die.
That system,
when the train crashes, just because a polar bear is wandering around, that doesn't mean that a human could survive.
It's probably true that all those people are going to die when the train crashes. But there was an alternative scenario in which perhaps the train came to a gentle halt and someone opened the door. And this is again the alternative. You're right. Like the alternative, this system in some ways has a self-perpetuating logic. They talk about this is a big theme throughout the movie, is everybody has their place in order to make the train, in order to make this train work. You have to stay in your place. You are born to be, an upper class, an elite, or a lower class, whatever it is. And in some ways, it's kind of true so long as you assume that the train is the only option.
Yeah.
And it present it, it again in terms of as social message and as sort of ways of thinking about systems of organizing society. What it says is that if you assume this is the only system that could ever exist, then you are going to perpetuate it forever. However, the alternative isn't reorganizing the train; it's getting out of it. It's escaping and building your own thing in some admittedly scary and difficult outer world.
And this is when Peter announces his seasteading plan with the rest of the libertarians.
You
so,
don't have to be complicit.
Exciting.
You can
very exciting.
Escape.
All right. Next week's assigned viewing, as Peter has hinted, spoiled for this whole little read I was going to do here. And I swear this was Alyssa's idea, not mine. I suggested we do Suicide Squad, but she really wanted to do it, so I'm not going to fight her on it. Is the one and only Sucker Punch by the one and only great Zack Snyder. We will watch that in preparation for Birds of Prey next week. That is it for Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. But before we go, I'd like to read a review off of our Apple Podcast page, where, as of this taping, we have 110 reviews, all of them 5 stars. We are 110 for 110. This week's review comes from Briefing Book, who says, quote, "I love the controversies and non-controversy segment of Across the Movie Aisle. Always smart and thought-provoking," end quote. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. If you loved it, tell your friends and review us at Apple like Briefing Book did. We need those reviews, people. If you didn't love it, just complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I will convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sonny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sonny Bunch and Natasha Passetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonnier. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sonny Bunch, with music by James Malone.